KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm very excited to have on the show Professor Shubha Ghosh of the University of Wisconsin Law School, discussing a piece that he is working on and will be presenting at a symposium that Elon University School of Law, my school, is going to be doing in October, entitled Commercializing Data. This is a topic that we've discussed with several guests on Hearsay Culture over the last few years. The issue of data mining and how data is used for purposes that people both know about and don't know about, and for which people may agree or not agree, is a topic that we often think about on the show. It's one that comes up in the context of everything from social media like Facebook to more serious situations like law enforcement scenarios. In our discussions over the last several months discussing fusion centers with people like Frank Pasquale and Daniel Citron, we have a running discussion about what data is and how data is used and what people, that is citizens, should know about how data is used. In commercializing data, which again is a work in progress, and so we're going to be having kind of an open-ended discussion, Shubha focuses on the basic question of what economic and social issues exist with the use of data in commercial settings. Because data has a variety of uses, there are a lot of questions that need to be addressed and answered with regard to what that data is and how it's used and what policies and laws should be in place to deal with those various scenarios. Shubha's piece, which again is in draft form, I've now said that three times in the first 2 minutes, but emphasizing it, is designed to, in its final form, discuss a variety of these issues and take a look at these issues from an interesting perspective, which is the working second part of the paper, Data Entrepreneurs and the Model of Sherlock Holmes. So we will get into some of that as well. But in his piece, Shubha takes a look at these questions, takes a look at various issues, including consumption and ownership of data that are important in this realm. And I think today, ultimately, we're going to have a pretty loose and open discussion about what data is and how data is used. So, with that in mind, let me give a brief background on Shubha. He's taught in the fields of intellectual property, business organizations, tort law, antitrust, property, and law and economics since 1996. He's a prodigious writer, the author of over 50 articles and book chapters. He also has two IP casebooks, and he has a variety of projects on which he is working. Shubha is joining us from his home in Wisconsin. And without further ado, Shubha, thank you for joining us today on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, David. I look forward to the discussion. I'm sure I'll get a lot out of it, and I hope the audience will as well.
Shubha, let's start off here, and I do appreciate your time and your flexibility and patience in getting the show going. Shubha, let me ask you a bit more about your background, and more specifically, I'll ask you, how did you become interested in intellectual property law generally, and why this topic now?
Well, that's going back quite a ways. My background as an undergraduate was in history and economics, and I've always been interested in economic history and economic development. So I did pursue graduate work in economics and eventually did get a PhD and taught in economics for a while before going to law school. And I got very much interested in intellectual property because of the intersection between law and economic systems, especially the ways in which the law towards innovation and progress, at least the way we understand it within U.S. intellectual property law. So that's sort of the intellectual background. In terms of my study of law, I found intellectual property just thrilling because it involved lots of different aspects of legal analysis, you know, common law, statutory law, constitutional law, international law, not to mention administrative and regulatory issues as well. So it's really kind of a fantastic area both to be a student in and then a teacher in. So I'm excited to be in that way. Go ahead.
Oh, no, please, continue.
And specifically in terms of the broader policy issues, I think intellectual property is where a lot of the big cutting-edge issues are. I think right now we're sort of bogged down in a lot of debates, which I think are largely statutory debates about patent reform and copyright reform, but the bigger questions are always going to be there in terms of how do we get a society to use the whole sets of its institutions, right? Markets, non-market institutions, social institutions, in order to move towards this idea of innovation.
Is intellectual property, as you see it today, a force to be reckoned with more broadly than even data, but with consumers generally? In other words, we always see these questions come up with regard to the hot-button popular issues like illegal downloading of music. But if we think about intellectual property law more broadly, and this kind of gets us to begin the discussion of commercializing data, how big a force is it to be reckoned with by consumers in their daily lives, in your view?
Well, I think this raises a really interesting question about you know, what the relevance of law is. How does law work in action? Is law even relevant? Or is it just sort of there in the background? I think to answer your direct question, I think it is sort of a force to be reckoned with. I think it can be either a force for good or a force for that's destructive. And I don't mean, you know, a creatively destructive way. I just mean the negatively destructive way. So that's why we really need to think about the policies behind intellectual property. I think for the, you know, the ordinary consumer, I think intellectual property is probably more of a force than other types of, you know, legal rights. You know, when we think about buying ordinary consumer goods, you know, maybe it's a six-pack of beer, maybe it's an automobile. There are obviously lots of legal rights that are in the background to that transaction, but they often can be hard to see. You kind of have to look very closely. Intellectual property is, you know, to be blunt about it, in some ways more in your face. It's as simple as when you turn on a movie and the first thing you see is a reminder of all the intellectual property rights that are in the background that brought you that that video or DVD to your home. So I think it's a force to be reckoned with, to be used to use your words. And that's why I think it's important to also have a lot of sort of consumer education about what intellectual property is and what intellectual property isn't.
And I'm glad you say that, because that is a focus of Hearsay Culture, to address these issues to a wide audience, both experts in the field as well as people that want to learn more. With regard to your piece, and again, I think probably the best way to begin this discussion is to ask you a basic definition. How do you define data?
Yeah, I view data as a building block in information society. So I view it as sort of a fundamental, basic concept on which other things like information, knowledge, and so forth are built. So I think what data is, to be more specific, sort of depends upon the context. So if you're talking about, for example, in a research lab context, in an experimental context, data might involve some sort of an observation that results from an experiment. Data in an economic context may involve fundamental information such as price and income. But I think the key thing to remember, David, is that we're always generating data. That's why I found the metaphor for Sherlock Holmes that I use early on in the paper very interesting to me, because that's largely how those stories were structured, around someone who is able to construct very broad narratives based upon what seems like very trivial facts.
And that analogy, I think, is something that I want to get to shortly as we think about these issues. Now, given that definition of data, you modify, or you focus, the paper is not called data, it's called commercializing data. And this is an issue the use of information, although we can drill down in your definition more specifically in a moment. My commercial entities is nothing new. It's been going on since, I'm sure, the dawn of time. The moment that someone wanted to sell or barter something with someone else, they had information that they intended to use in order to determine what the price should be and what should be sold and what have you. In the context that in which you're writing, what do you mean by commercialization?
Well, what I mean by commercialization is really sort of highlighting, a tension between two notions of data or information wanting to be free. I realize I'm slipping there a little bit between data and information, but that's sort of more the common parlance that I'm referring to. So one notion is this idea that we should have open government. We have things like data.gov, where basic governmental data is made available to the public. But on the other hand, we have a notion that data has to be used. And by that, what that means largely in our society is that somebody has to make some sort of profit out of it in order for the use of that data to actually become viable. And I find that sort of an interesting tension. I think that may be a tension that maybe more fundamental than the problem that I'm addressing. Maybe the notion of having democracy and market society is what I'm sort of pointing to. But that's what I mean by commercializing data. That's why I'm focusing on that standpoint. On the one hand, information and data is openly available. On the other hand, the use of that information or data requires some sort of profit motive in order for it to become viable. So that's why I took that as the focus, and that's largely the definition that I'm working with.
You've written, as I mentioned in the introduction, Shuba, extensively in IP. Are there previous works of yours upon which you were drawing or building in putting this piece together?
I think there are a number of pieces, especially this piece draws on some things I worked on, about 10 years ago now, on commercializing legal statutes. There's an article I wrote about privatization and copyright law, and I guess privatization and intellectual property law more broadly, because a lot of the questions that arose here came out of a 2004 case called Wire Data versus Assessment Technologies, which was a Wisconsin case that initially went up to the Seventh Circuit, the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, which Wisconsin's a part, and that was also the subject of a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision 2 years ago. But that issue had to do with access to tax assessment records, and there are a number of ways in which my earlier work on privatization come up here. One way is that a lot of municipalities in Wisconsin and in other jurisdictions have privatized, have outsourced, have basically contracted with private entities to collect this tax assessment information and to develop databases and methodologies to make tax assessments. And so that question then arises as to how we how the government should operate with those forms of privatization.
We're talking with Professor Shuba Ghosh of University of Wisconsin Law School on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Shuba, as you know, you and I share this common interest in how government uses information. I've more narrowly written on the trade secrecy aspects of these issues. But the examples that you raise are good ones, and they bring to mind another scenario, which I found both humorous and sad in the same context. I kind of want to get your reaction to it in terms of whether these are problems with which the law can grapple and should the law grapple with it. The scenario I want to posit to you, a law that will save lives, occurred at this point, maybe 5-6 years ago in Hoboken, New Jersey, a place that I lived for a few years when I was practicing law in New York. Hoboken contracted The city of Hoboken, I should say, contracted with a private entity to operate their garages for cars. And these garages had elevators and lifts that operated on proprietary software provided by the vendor. As often happens, a contract dispute arose, and when that dispute arose, the city and the contractor were unable to resolve their issues, and the contractor basically abandoned the site and took their software with them. The result was that, again, humorous and sad, cars that were on the upper levels of this garage were locked in place because the city did not have access to the software and could not operate. Keeping in mind, these are public lots, could not operate these lifts without the software provided by the contract vendor. Of course, the contract vendor, in the context in which I was writing, were claiming that this software itself were trade secrets, or parts of them were, which undoubtedly they were under the law. But the result was that the city was crippled. Now, again, governments and the private sector partner in a variety of areas, and those partnerships seem to be increasing by significant orders of magnitude over the last several years and few decades. There's nothing wrong with those partnerships, are there?
No. I didn't mean to imply that by any means. Of course not. Those, as you said early on, those types of partnerships have always been there. I think, we've battled the last decade, at least in legal theory, between this public-private distinction, and we sort of recognize that that distinction is somewhat an artificial one and is largely political in some ways. And I think that informs a lot of the issues about privatization as well. So I certainly not. Of course, those types of partnerships are very important. One of the things that I've written about, for example, in the area of patent law is the Bayh-Dole Act, and that's opened up a lot of these private-public partnerships that have benefited many areas, including the University of Wisconsin, in terms of commercializing innovations that come out of state universities. So, no, I'm not saying anything against privatization. I'm just saying we should analyze it and try to understand some of the dynamics. And the example you gave is a really good example of some of the issues that we have to deal with in the context of privatization.
When we think that example, and perhaps I can drill down the question more specifically and say this, the scenario that I described boils down to a contract dispute, ultimately. Is there any reason to be concerned about that scenario from an IP or data, as you define it, standpoint?
Well, sure. I think the example of the locked cars are very, very interesting. We have a lot of these public-private partnerships that give rise or the creation of data and databases. And one of the big issues that that arise in that context then are our ownership of the underlying data. Who gets access to that? How do they get access to that? And what uses are made possible when access is made possible? I mean, if you look at, for example, data.gov has a fairly interesting and extensive, what's called terms of uses, or terms that dictate how the data can be used. And there's nothing within the terms of use on data.gov that limits commercialization of data, but they do have restrictions or do have conditions that limit the ability to deny access to data. So right. I don't know whether that's the right compromise and so forth. So in other words, you can commercialize, but you have to basically keep the underlying data open, which is largely the position of the Seventh Circuit in 2004 in the Wire Data versus Assessment Technologies case as well. So I think I'm not sure if I have an interesting solution to the parking garage in New Jersey, in Hoboken that you gave earlier, other than maybe there's some possibility to have the software in escrow or to protect consumers somehow within the contractual terms or within the way in which that parking garage had been operated. I'd have to think about that some more, how that scenario would... But, of course, that kind of scenario could arise even if it was just a purely private operation as well, right? It's just a bad... What you described just seems to be a very badly run business.
Or, well, that's right. You know,
a business transaction that just went woefully awry.
Right.
And that's where the lawyers can come in and the business folks can come in to think about how to structure that. And certainly the licensing and the use of intellectual property would be part of that business model as well.
And that's where, you know, these issues, I think, become particularly challenging, as you alluded to, because while one could easily say, yeah, I want access to my car, when viewed merely as a contract dispute between two contracting parties, it's really kind of run-of-the-mill. And so that data, in this case software, became critical to the utility of the garage to anyone that attempted to use it, and the unfortunate people had their cars locked in it. You mentioned data.gov, and I think this transitions. Can you describe data.gov in a bit more detail and their definition of data?
Sure. Data.gov is a website that started by the federal government that basically allows consumers to log on. It's completely open and be able to access the government data at various agencies that may not otherwise be protected, let's say, by privacy or business secrets and so forth. It does allow individuals to download the data, for example, things like census data or information about national parks and so forth. And then, as I mentioned before, the terms of use don't say anything about not being able to commercialize that data, though it does say that the data, you can't put restrictions on further use of the data by third parties. So I would describe the terms of use as a sort of open source contract terms. It doesn't necessarily have all the elements of open source, but it has some of the basic ones that would allow individuals to make use but not deny access to other parties. It has a very interesting definition of data. So let me just read that to you from the website. It says,
great.
Data are values or sets of values representing a specific concept or concept. So just to stop there, it's a very broad definition, right? So it talks about values or sets of values. That suggests that within data.gov, it's talking about quantitative data. Rather than qualitative data. That hasn't been litigated or discussed, but that's maybe an interesting distinction to look at. But then we're talking about these values, presumably quantitative, that are representing something, right? So they are referring to something else. And again, what they're referring to or representing, the website defines as fairly broad, a specific concept or concepts. So they're talking here about maybe population size, land mass, rainfall, you know, whatever the background concept is that's being represented in some sort of quantitative form. So again, it's a very broad definition. It sounds acontextual, but it's not. I mean, you have to have some notion of what these concepts or concepts are, and that might change from situation to situation. Even the notion of value, I think, is very interesting. As I say, it's quantitative, but, you know, the quantitativeness of it would reflect, you know, however things are measured in a particular context, right? And those have certain choices to be made as to how you measure something, right? Something as simple as the units, how you measure them, when you measure them, and so forth. The other aspect of this definition that's interesting, just to continue with the quote from the website, the definition of data goes on to say, data become information here in quotes, when analyzed and possibly combined with other data in order to extract meaning and to provide context. The meaning of data can vary according to its context. I find that very interesting because, first of all, conceptually, data versus information, I kind of slipped earlier just because I was sort of using the layperson's notions of those concepts. But there is a distinction within the website and also more generally between data and information. One way to kind of understand that is that information is basically processed data. It's data that's gone through some sort of analysis in order to create some other type of meaning. Now, if you want to be really glib about it, it's just, you know, data at another level in some ways, right? To go back to the Sherlock Holmes metaphor, I mean, he would start with one aspect of data, maybe the way in which somebody walks, and then goes from there to some other type of data, the fact that the person may have been stationed in Afghanistan, or a doctor, right? So, but here, the difference would be the first level of data, just the way the person walks, would be data, and then the information would be the processing of that data. Now, the reason why I make that distinction is because within IP, within intellectual property, specifically copyright law, but certainly other aspects of intellectual property law as well, there is a distinction. I mean, for example, in copyright law, we talk about how facts cannot be copyrighted, but the selection, the organization and arrangement of facts can be, for example, in the form of a database. And that's sort of the notion that's going on here, that once data is processed and it becomes information, then it becomes another quantity almost, another factor. And the interesting thing I want to mention about this is we talk a lot about data being open and free, and within the website, there's a lot of notion of having open access to data. But one of the things that is sort of open here, kind of thing, an open question is information free? Mm-hmm. So once the data gets processed in certain forms, can that be made proprietary and can we deny access to information? I think the general view probably would be yes. You think about, for example, in the context of the press, we can get the underlying facts that might be out there, but once they get processed into a news story, that news story can be copyrighted, and that news story would be the analogy of information.
We are talking with Professor Shubha Ghosh of University of Wisconsin Law School on KZSU-FM Stanford. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless of what you do, I do hope that you continue to listen to the show. Shubha, so with regard to the analogy to Sherlock Holmes and to mysteries generally, and even in, you know, your current draft of the article, you make reference to not only Sherlock Holmes, but as you call them, the literature of information authors like Gass and Thomas Pynchon and Philip K. Dick. How do you integrate both the mystery and these fiction writers, albeit great fiction writers into the commercializing data focus?
Well, let's see where to start with that. I think part of it is trying to understand the mindset or the worldview that we're operating in terms of which markets are functioning. And to sort of elaborate on that point a little bit, I find that literary world, I mean, if you think about the novels of Philip K. Dick, they're all about ways in which you've got a dystopian future in which data has been, or information really at that point, has been commercialized to such a situation where there's some genuine questions, and I'm using the word genuine here sort of as a pun, about authenticity and about individual identity. So I think that literature is really very, very prophetic about where the world of commercialization of data and information might go. So that's why, when I wrote the paper and as I'm drafting that paper, I thought that was a very interesting kind of you know, background in terms of trying to understand, you know, the world we live in. And, you know, a lot of those writers are trying to struggle with this, you know, kind of fundamental sort of normative question about, you know, what does it mean to live in a world where, you know, facts themselves can be manipulated in this particular way and can be the real sort of resource that's being used, for profit. So that's why I thought that literary background, was fairly interesting. I think in terms of, thinking about business models, you know, what the implication of commercializing data is for contemporary markets, and this is where the intellectual property overlap comes in again. If you think about societies that are based on manufacturing, or even societies that are based upon service, you know, which was sort of the big divide that people were talking about in the 70s and 80s and people still talk about now, the notion of what the background resources were that entrepreneurs, that business people were tapping are very different than what we're talking about now. If you're talking about manufacturing, you're largely talking about natural resources. In a service economy, you're talking largely about how people can make money off of their labor. The interesting thing about, you know, the society we're living in and the project of commercializing data is that this resource can be anywhere, mm-hmm. right? You gave the example about Facebook, and again, we can get into a debate about the merits and demerits of Facebook and a lot of these other social networking sites, but one of the things that those sites are trying to do is generate a stream of data that then can be the basis for commercialization in whatever form. You know, largely we've been working on advertising models now, but largely the data from there then can be generated to what we call information databases that, you know, absent some sort of legal regulation, if you think about it as just a purely free market, you know, would be bought and sold. And I think that's a very, you know, fundamental shift in some ways. We're not just simply talking about a service economy anymore. We are talking about a manufacturing economy of sorts, but it's one in which what's being manufactured is basically produced by consumers of things like, you know, Facebook and a lot of these, you know, internet sites that, you know, we've referred to already. So that's the kind of notion that this paper is trying to kind of pick apart and explore a little bit under the rubric of commercialization of data. And to get back to your original question, that's why I think a lot of these authors who were writing in the 1970s were actually quite prophetic about.
Are there particular works of these authors that you think of? I mean, in other words, for listeners that are interested in reading some of these novels, if they haven't already, are there any particular works that you would point them to?
I'm not quite sure where to start with this. And just to emphasize with this, I mean, I view myself as largely a legal and social science scholar, and I like to integrate the literary things because I think there's a lot to be gleaned from. So I don't want to, you know, kind of mislead people about this paper, but you're right to point out that I do use these authors as backgrounds. I've always been a fan of the novelist Thomas Pynchon, and I think, you know, you think about Gravity's Rainbow. Gravity's Rainbow is largely about, you know, information society and kind of the misuses of information. This is a rated G show. Is that right? Or I don't know how much to get into the details of them.
We operate under FCC regulations. So
yeah, I won't use any. I won't have a language malfunction here.
Yeah.
but the basic premise in Gravity's Rainbow involved a U.S. GI in London whose sexual conquest map onto the landings of V2 rockets from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole first part of the novel involved investigators at Bletchley Park trying to find out why there is this correlation between this GI's conquests, so to speak, and bombings by Germany. So there's a really great discussion early on in that novel about, well, is this completely random? Is this somehow being willed by this GI? Is there some sort of... So there's a really interesting discussion about whether you know, human life is just purely random, or are there connections between these things? And, you know, in a later work by Thomas Pynchon, which I thought is really interesting, Vineland, which came out in 1989, but is about 1984. It takes place in 1984 and involves sort of these ex-hippies from the 1960s, some of whom have sold out and became informants to the government. It's a little bit extreme in some of its politics, but there's one part that was very interesting and involved, remember this novel takes place in 1984, and it involved a teenage girl who basically tries to rediscover her mother and her radical past in the 60s by watching old films. But the description of how she watches the films are a lot like basically how you and I probably search things on the internet. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting how people sort of learn about the history now, right? How they learn about the world by searches. And I think, you know, one of the things that's very prophetic about Pynchon is how he writes about kind of internet culture, you know, decades before the internet really came on the scene.
Right.
So I could go on and on about various examples of this, but, you know, I think there's a richness there in terms of how that particular novelist captures data, the way in which data gets transformed into information, and the way in which markets and governments are sort of entwined in that process.
I was thinking, I find this interesting, Shubin, and if you would indulge us about one more minute, I was thinking with regard to the other authors that Almond Center's Luck by Gass, and perhaps
right.
the Man in the High Castle, which I think is maybe I think a lot of critics think is Philip K. Dick's best work, also fit this mold.
Right. Yeah, I'm more of a Pynchon fan. I like Philip K. Dick quite a bit, actually. But I think Pynchon, in terms of capturing the history, I was going to mention his 1997 novel, Mason and Dixon, which is largely about, it's a very boring topic if you just describe it this way. It's basically about how Charles Mason and Jeremiah Dixon plotted the Mason and Dixon line, you know, which doesn't sound like riveting reading. But the whole idea of surveying and creating boundary lines, right, largely talking about real property, you know, in that novel is actually a metaphor for, you know, kind of rationality and information society more broadly. So there's actually kind of a historical resonance in Pynchon that I find, you know, which I find really kind of very interesting.
The last thing I'll ask you on Pynchon before we get back to data is, how long did it take you to read Gravity's Rainbow?
Oh, you know, I was kind of fortunate because I had it read to me. When I was in college, they did a reading of Gravity's Rainbow, and so I listened to most of it before I actually read it. I think the reading may have taken about 2 days or so. When I sat down and read it, I kind of spent some time with it. So, I don't know, maybe a month or so.
Yeah, I was going to say, because reading the book, I mean, it's far better, but it kind of reminded me of Dune in the number of characters that appear
right.
and disappear. But at any rate, okay. Well, it's interesting stuff, and I think it's useful to contextualize your work. With regard to getting back to these issues of commercializing of data, one of the topics that we've discussed on Hearsay Culture quite a bit, and we have about 15 minutes left in the show, to discuss it a bit is data mining generally. This is the kind of behavior that tends to raise red flags with privacy advocates and civil rights advocates and people that are concerned about how the government uses data. How would you let me ask you this question. What is your general view of data mining in the context of commercialization? Do you have an opinion on it?
Yeah, that's something that this paper, as I develop, will need to kind of, you know, explore a little bit more. At some level, it's inevitable. I mean, that's kind of the metaphor of Sherlock Holmes, and the whole notion of the data entrepreneur that I talk about in the paper comes in, and that's largely, you know, data mining. You know, I made the reference before to manufacturing society, and it's really kind of the modern version by which value is extracted for the purposes of commercializing data. So in some ways, it's inevitable, and therefore I think it's something that needs to be scrutinized and looked at very closely. This is where I think, you know, why my interest in this paper is so strong. Because on the one hand, I like the idea of having data being open. But on the other hand, in the sense that I like the idea because anybody can then download the data, look at it, find patterns, you know, find things that maybe nobody has ever seen before, you know, really kind of keep the various entities that the data is trying to measure or trying to capture, you know, accountable. But on the other hand, it really kind of makes me nervous. I mean, at some level, you do have these issues about where information, knowledge is just simply rumor and hearsay. I mean, how do you make those distinctions between these various categories that we have? How do you generate or distinguish between, you know, actual knowledge and junk knowledge?
Right.
So this is where we need to really look very carefully, you know, especially, you know, with respect to the issues you mentioned regarding privacy and security, you know, what the new, you know, forms of regulation are going to be. You know, I'm very much a 60s liberal in some ways, even though, you know, I came of age at a different time. So I'm always trying to think about this in terms of what the rules and regulations are going to be to keep the bad things from happening. And I think that's where, you know, a lot of this work I hope will be headed, and I hope our discussion will be headed as well.
Well, I will give you the opening to head the discussion in that direction.
Okay, is that a question?
It's almost a question. I was giving the opportunity to take it in that direction, but perhaps I'll ask it this way. How do you connect those dots?
Yeah, well, I think of this as a long-term project, so I wish I had sort of kind of the master plan that I could give you now. I think the idea behind data.gov makes a lot of sense. I think we need to also be able to have institutions that inform people on how best to manage and analyze data. And part of this, you know, we do already. I mean, I think, you know, Ian Ayers had this book called Super Crunchers, which I do talk a little bit about in this article, where, and I think a number of people have mentioned, I think Hal Varian have talked about how, I think it was at a graduation speech, where the next generation of cool people are going to be statisticians. And certainly you need to have knowledge in statistics and that type of data analysis for the quantitative data. But I think you also have to have some sort of education in sensitivity to data, right? So we sort of have this within universities with things like internal review boards, when we have research scientists that go out and, let's say, interview or do survey research or do other types of research for certain disadvantaged populations or sensitive populations. And, you know, universities have rules about how those types of information should be gathered, how privacy of individuals need to be protected, even issues about, you know, making money off of that type of data. So I think our education and how we do and manage information, not only simply our own information, but also the information that we might glean from others, you know, we really kind of have to think about how to do that. So the way I analogize this is, I think in the 70s or 80s, I think I became aware of this more in the 80s, I guess, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, teaching people from a very early age about financial management. So I think a lot of elementary schools and junior high schools in the 80s, you know, toyed with giving students you know, a credit card or teaching them how to use things like debt or those types of instruments. We need to really kind of think about that as well as far as data management. And certainly IP is part of that. Intellectual property is part of that. And, you know, when I teach that at the law school level, and sometimes I've given lectures at the university and college levels as well, you know, we try to emphasize this is not just simply about, you know, the rules of copyright, patents, trademarks, and trade secrets, but really about how we manage information. The problem is that if it's only left only to intellectual property, a lot is lost, right? We don't really talk that much about privacy issues. We don't really talk that much about some of these other issues in the context of intellectual property. That seems to take a proprietary model as its starting point rather than some sort of a management or a regulatory model. And that's again another background to this project that I'm working on.
We have about 7 minutes left here, 7-8 minutes, Shubha. And I do want to ask you about one point that you make in that connection, which is the inability to predict future uses of data. And that's a significant problem, really, not only for data but for technology generally.
Right.
And so I'm curious to get your thoughts on that. How does that problem manifest itself in commercializing data?
Well, I think part of it is in the archiving, right? I don't know, we have things like the Wayback Machine that allow us to recapture things that we might have thought have been conveniently lost. Or even outside of cash, conveniently lost. So I think we need to think about more the archival aspect of this. So, this does come up in intellectual property as an interesting issue. We often think about intellectual property as about innovation, and clearly it is that has as a central focus. But there is an issue within intellectual property that informs things like museum management or library sciences. How do we understand intellectual property in an archival sense? So, one way in which I think we haven't really fully grappled with this issue is that we think about the public domain as, the works have been under copyright protection or patent protection. Now they're in the public domain. But we need to think about ways in which we manage the public domain. And maybe that would be an even better title for this paper or for future papers. Managing the public domain. And I think, there are tools within intellectual property that try to deal with that. But unfortunately, as I mentioned before, we only view intellectual property from a proprietary model rather than from a management or regulatory model. And therefore, we need to kind of think about the archiving aspects of information. And I know that, and this is a little bit outside of my expertise, but I know that there are folks in schools of library science, people who are involved with museum studies, where that's their primary focus, or increasingly the focus has been coming into play, in those contexts.
And that's a huge issue also with music librarians, a community that I know well in previous work, where these problems have manifested themselves in very fundamental ways, which is why can't we make another copy of Edward Meeker's recording from 1921 on a cylinder when there is no market for it,
right?
And yet the law stands in the way of it. Shubha, we have about 5 minutes left, and I do want to ask you a couple of forward thinking type questions.
Okay.
You're going to be presenting this paper, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, at Elon Law School Symposium in October, that deals with transparency and data and government operations generally. And those of you that are interested in the symposium can find out more about it by going to elonlaw.elon.edu, where you can find more information about the school as well as the symposium. Where do you envision the paper ultimately being in terms of where you're going to come out on these issues? I know that as a researcher and as a scholar, we enter into these projects with open minds and we let the data and what we learn guide us in terms of our conclusions. Do you have any hunches at this point?
Well, I think one of the issues that I want to sort of end up with is, or really kind of hopefully have a better sense of, is this distinction between data and information. Because this comes up in lots of different contexts. I mentioned in the context of databases. It comes up a little bit in the notion of trade secret law. In some ways, it comes up even in the notion of patent law in terms of when we talk about something as being ready to patent. And the way, to take another metaphor that I use in the paper has things other than metaphors in it. So don't view it as sort of a poetic enterprise purely. But I talk about this distinction between raw data and cooked data. or raw data and processed data. So I really want to end up with sort of really understanding the different ways in which data does get processed and really trying to develop and understand the ways in which institutions should be more attuned to the processing of data. I know data processing is such a, you know, kind of a mundane word, so I hate to kind of use it. So the Cook data has sort of a kind of a greater resonance with it, even though that has sort of negative connotations, but that's the, you know, it's from anthropology, Raw versus Cook. But we need to think about, you know, business practices, institutional practices, as well as, you know, regulatory rules and institutions that deal with the way in which data does get processed and data does get turned into information. I mentioned before how a lot of universities do this through their internal review boards, but we need to maybe think about that as sort of a broader model. And I think ultimately, you know, this has got to be, you know, context specific, so that data slash information in the context of pharmaceuticals may have a different structure, a different set of rules, let's say, than data slash information in the context of environmental, or data slash information in the context of tax assessment records. So I think this paper is largely trying to get us to think about this issue. So I largely view this as a paper that largely about, you know, thinking about the management of information, both from a legal and a business standpoint. What are the kind of questions? What's the kind of mindset? You know, what is the type of worldview that you should develop, you know, to be able to manage these effectively?
Shubha, for those people that want to learn more about your work and what you do, do you have any place where that you can point them?
My work specifically?
Yes.
Or you mean this topic?
No, yeah, well, I was going to say your work specifically, and then afterwards, this topic more broadly.
Sure. You know, my work, you know, specifically, I mean, I have a website on the University of Wisconsin Law School page, and there are links there to my CV and to various articles. I have the Social Science Research Network has a lot of my you know, ongoing papers and my you know, published papers as well. And if people want to contact me directly, I'd welcome that as well. I won't give my email address over the air, but you know, it's available on the website publicly. So if people want to, you know, take the effort to go there and get it from there, they're welcome to ask more questions based on what we've talked about now. You know, The Economist had a really great issue earlier this year on, you know, data commercialization, information, a lot of the topics we've talked about. So if you go to www.theeconomist.com, I think that's their website for the magazine The Economist, they had a really good insert on these issues. And one of the books they've cited is this book called Full Disclosure, The Perils and Promise of Transparency by Fung, Graham, and Weir. Wild. I'm just looking at it from my shelf here. So I'd recommend that as a good book, not just simply about the U.S., but about some of the international issues. And that's something that this paper doesn't get into, but it's something I want to learn a little bit more about, and I would love to hear from your audience and also at your conference about some of the international issues. Because I know that, for example, the U.K., there have been some movements recently to adopt a legislation that's modeled on the U.S.'s Freedom of Information Act. And I've been trying to look a little bit more in terms of how different states deal with Open Records Act, and those have raised a lot of interesting questions. We've talked about data and information, but there's a whole other category called a record, which, you know, raises independent legal questions and management questions as well. So I hope that gives your audience a sense of some of the other resources that are available.
I think it does, Shuba. And at this point, because we've run out of time, I do want to thank you for taking the time on Hearsay Culture to chat with my audience. I very much look forward not only to seeing you at the symposium in October, and I'm sure I'll see you at one or two other conferences before then, but also to invite you back on the show, perhaps once the piece is completed, to see where the piece ultimately went and what we can say about it. So thank you so much for being on the show today, Shuba. Again, I appreciate your patience and flexibility, thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you, David. It's a great program. I look forward to your conference in October.
Sounds good. Thank you, Shuba. I'm looking forward to having a number of additional guests coming on for the rest of the summer quarter. Among them are, coming up next week, Laura DeNardis, the Executive Director of the Information Society Project at Yale Law School and author of Protocol Politics, A Globalization of Internet Governance, Jeremy Malcolm of Consumers International, Paul Jones from iBiblio.org, a person that's been involved in the technology world for decades, Professors Eduardo Penalver of Cornell Law and Sonia Kotyal of Fordham Law discussing their book Property Outlaws, Professor Rob Frieden of Penn State's College of Communications discussing winning the Silicon Sweepstakes, Evgeny Morozov of Foreign Policy and author of How Dictators Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Web. Associate Dean Michael Madison of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law will be on. I've been a fan of his work for quite a while, and I'll be looking forward to talking with him. And rounding out the summer quarter will be Professor Oded Schenker of Ohio State University's Fisher College of Business, author of a very interesting book on innovation theory called Copycats. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can pick up the show by going, of course, live to KZSU from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays to pick up the show, but you can also get it by podcast. There are a number of ways to get it through to get the podcast. You can get it one way is through iTunes, through Stanford Law School's Center for Internet Society's iTunes page. You can also pick up the show by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all current programs, previous programs, and blogging on occasion. And you can also get the show by getting the RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thank you much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. I hope you enjoyed the show. Please stay tuned for more diverse programming on KZSU-FM Stanford, and have a great day.